We're going to look here tonight at John G. Peyton. Glad to see you. It's going to be really interesting tonight, okay? There's some aspects of his story that are going to grab your attention. I'm confident of it today. How many of you know his story? A little bit? I really didn't. Even the name was not familiar to me until quite recently. We have one of a copy of his autobiography in our library. There's a couple newer revisions. His brother did a lot of the compiling, and 30 years with South Sea Cannibals. Anybody in the parent row over there know what a cannibal is? All right, we're gonna talk about it. You're gonna wanna pay attention. So again, he was born. I think we have a picture here of him in his later years. He was born in Scotland, but his story would really unfold in a remote cluster of islands in the South Pacific. Right, so these particular islands were discovered, at least sort of by the Western world, in 1606 by the Spanish explorer Fernandez de Quiros. And a chain of 80 islands stretching over 450 miles. But as you can see, not exactly on what we think of as the beaten path, right? I mean, this is off, you know, the closest major continent there would be Australia, but this is just an area that developed the natives or the nationals or whatever you want to call them would have lived there. They trace back the society there at least 3,300 years. So a lot of society developing, but isolated from the mainstream of the known world. So just a very interesting part of the world. These islands would later be called the New Hebrides. Again, that ties in a little bit, even the name ties in a little bit with the unfolding history. So before we even get to John Peyton, I want to think a little bit about that history. In the 18th century, of course, they were discovered by the Spanish explorer, but at some point later in the 1700s, they were colonized by both the British and the French. The two countries actually would eventually enter into an agreement holding the islands or ruling the islands in a condominium. I had never heard that term as it relates to a geopolitical type of thing, but a condominium is a political territory controlled by two authorities. That kind of makes sense when we think of condominiums. They're shared. You own them, but they're shared. They're shared ownership. So that was the kind of the case with these islands. Shared ownership between the British and the French. In 1980, they would gain their independence and be renamed the Republic of Vanuatu. Right, and there's again another country that I had never heard of. All right, relatively new country, I guess, if you want to think of it that way. In the 80s, Vanua means land or home, and the word tu. So you got Vanuatu. The word tu means stand, or it has the idea of basically that we are a country standing on our own now. You know, that's the meaning of the word, and a couple of word concepts there in their culture. They're an independent country now. And they have this new status. The French and English influence is still felt on the islands. But the official language of Vanuatu is Bislama, which is a pidgin language. From what I can tell, not all that different from what we read when we read the Jesus book, right? That's Hawaiian pidgin English, but this would be part of a similar sort of language group. But in addition to that, Bislama and French and English, there are 113 indigenous languages. So increasingly, this Bislama has sort of become the dominant language, but a lot of little people groups tucked away in these 80 islands spread over 450 miles. So I just think about the missions aspects of this, right? We're concerned about these people, and where do you even start? You know. So John, back to John Patton, Caton. He grew up as the oldest of 11 children in a vibrant Christian home in the countryside of Scotland. His father was a tailor of sorts. He made at a small shop in which he made stockings. John's father had grown up in a home where the scriptures were read on Sundays. But as a young Christian, John himself came to Christ at the age of 17. And as he married, his father implemented a daily time of Bible reading and prayer for the family. So, and John describes his growing up years as just very joyful. His parents had a very genuine faith. They observed the Christian Sabbath, but he said it was in a way that was never dull or restrictive. It was a day of stories and eating and being together as a family. Dr. Greer, who taught at the seminary for many years, was of Scottish descent, and his family had maintained some of those. He talked about the rigidness of the Presbyterian model of Sabbath observance, and it could often be, you know, don't say anything, be quiet, you know, a bit oppressive. And that was not John's experience. He just grew up really relishing that day of being together as a family and enjoying good food and conversation. And so this is just the kind of home that he grew up in, a warm and inviting home with vibrant faith. His father was a strict disciplinarian, but he would, whenever there was any significant discipline to be meted out, his father would retreat to his closet for prayer. John said it was the worst. You know, like his conscience was just working on him the whole time, you know, and of course you're not sure what dad's going to come out with in terms of punishment. But very clear sense that his dad was in control of his emotions, right? It wasn't just lashing out in anger. I mean, again, it was just a very thorough, settled faith that was being lived out in his home. John indicates that his father... Here was his statement. I think I included this about his description of his father. My father had a strong desire to be a minister of the gospel, but when he finally saw that God's will had marked out for him another lot, he reconciled himself by entering with his own soul into this solemn vow that if God gave him sons, he would consecrate them unreservedly to the ministry of Christ if the Lord saw fit to accept the offering and open up their way. So I've seen several elements there. First, he had this passion for ministry, but he recognized it wasn't how God had wired him. It wasn't his assignment in life. That's a good place to come to. God's assigned us to all sorts of different places, right? But he had a heart for ministry, and he said, God, I want to be open. If you want to use my kids, my sons in particular, in ministry in some intensive way, I would love to offer them to you. I mean, that's just a great spirit that is evidenced here. And three of his sons, including John, of course, did enter gospel ministry. John would study theology and also medicine as he had a growing burden for the unreached islanders of the South Pacific. So he had this in his mind. He relates... a particular meeting of the Presbyterian Church, like the churches would gather, right, for their large annual meeting. And this issue of the New Hebrides, right, was something that had been brought to the churches. And remember, they had put out advertisements for the previous 2 years saying, we are looking for someone who would be willing to go. And to no responses, right? And so they got together on this third year, and they said, we're going to essentially cast lots. We're going to have all the pastors gathered in the room, want you to take and write out three names of one of the pastors that you think should be sent, should be freed from their current ministry commitments and be sent to the New Hebrides. And so everybody turned in their things, they're very solemn. He's John's watching this as a young man. He's watching this unfold, and they go back and they tabulate, and they said, you know, the ones that get the highest nominations will view that as part of God's call. And so essentially they came back and there was no clear consensus. And so they shared this with the group, and John found himself crying that they couldn't find anybody to go. And so he committed it to prayer, but in a very short time later, offered himself up to be the one that would go. And his decision was met with tremendous resistance. Not from his parents, as we just read, but from most everyone else, including one of the elders there at the church. And there were reasons why there was resistance. This is a glamorized picture, but a lot of the body paint, and of course they're depicted there with their weapons, the piercings through the nose and large shells and such in various parts of their body. But these were a violent people. So I talked about cannibals, right? In 1839, this is before John made his venture to the New Hebrides, but in 1839, two London missionaries by the names of Williams and Harris attempted to bring the gospel to these people for the first time, these people, the islanders, but they were clubbed to death and eaten by the cannibals only minutes after getting ashore. Not a lot of good progress, right? I mean, just really horrible stuff. Another group, 1842, barely escaped with their lives, right? So this is the context. This is the growing reputation. This is a nasty place, right? A very dangerous place. Everyone's trying to talk him out of it, including one of the church elders. And here was his response to Mr. Dixon, the church elder. Mr. Dixon, you are advanced in years now, and your own prospect is soon to be laid in the grave, there to be eaten by worms. I confess to you that if I can but live and die serving and honoring the Lord Jesus, it will make no difference to me whether I am eaten by cannibals or by worms. That's pretty good, yeah. So that's a great, just eternal perspective, isn't it? So off he goes. The year was 1858. He was ordained. He married Mary Ann Robson that year. And that same year, they set sail for New Hebrides, this chain of islands. They arrived on the island of Tanna. 3 months after their arrival, Mary gave birth to their son Peter. But within 3 weeks, Mary died of malaria. And another 2 weeks later, Peter died as well, their newborn son. So, just immediate travail and grief and opposition that they encountered on every front. 8 years later, he would return, so he carried on. Not a lot of visible results. 8 years later, he returned to Scotland to raise more funds, to raise more attention, to recruit more gospel workers. He remarried. He married a woman named Maggie Whitcross. And they would come back to a new island this time, the island of Unawa. They would go on to have 10 children, 4 of whom would die in infancy. So again, just a hard life, but they persisted. He describes one particular case, several attempts made on his life through the years. On one occasion, Billy Graham actually shared this particular account that hostile natives surrounded his home, and he knew that they were intent on doing him harm. The drums were beating, all these sort of characteristic things. And they engaged in prayer, John and Maggie, and the night passed, and sure enough, the people were gone. A year later, the chief came to Christ, like one of the first real breakthroughs in ministry, and he asked the chief about that night. And the chief said this. He said they had seen many men standing guard, hundreds of big men in shining garments with drawn swords in their hands, so that we were afraid to attack. So it was just John and his wife. But this tribal chief saw hundreds of strong soldiers guarding their house, right? So these were presumably guardian angels that God had sent to watch over them and preserve their life. John would learn the language in order to translate the scriptures. He ended up translating the scriptures, the New Testament portion of the scriptures into their local language. They ministered to the sick, dispensed medicines. Maggie taught groups of women and girls to read and to sew. And after years of deprivation, danger, and disease, essentially the entire island of Aniwa professed faith in Jesus Christ. And that New Testament Bible was printed and gifted to the tribe. The Bible proved to be, I love this picture here, because here he is, the chieftain with a weapon there at his side and very, you know, angry looking and kind of a defiant posture. And here's John Payton with his Bible in hand. And we would say, oh, well, the gun is more powerful, right? The sword, the bow and arrow are more powerful than a Bible. But what prevailed was the Bible at the end of the day. Christianity is the predominant religion in Vanuatu. 83% of the total population. And about a third of that Christian population is aligned with the Presbyterian Church, a direct result of John Payton's ministry. So a few lessons, just to try to summarize here. One, there are no insignificant people. Right? I'm struck by the minute size of this little cluster of islands. Completely off the beaten path, seemingly irrelevant group of people, violent group of people, but Payton recognized that they were valuable to God. And I think it was a pattern that was established even earlier in his life. He worked with a lot of the street kids in the city of Glasgow in Scotland as he was growing up. This was something he didn't just flip the switch on, but had been inculcated in his life. And I was thinking of it again in light of Luke's gospel, Jesus with his disciples. Remember that encounter where the woman with the issue of blood touches Jesus? I mean, the crowds are all gathering around and Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" And the disciples are like, "Everyone touched you, you know? I mean, come on." But Jesus had this sensitivity for people, right? I mean, he saw people. He wanted his disciples to see people. And John Payton saw people. He was crying that day when he realized no one was going to this island, this group of islanders, right? And committed to go himself. They're no insignificant people. We're called to do hard and dangerous things. Number two, we're called to do hard and dangerous things. We're not called to live safe lives. That's not the goal that we ought to have for ourselves. It's not God's promise to us that He's going to give us an easy life. Matter of fact, Jesus told his disciples just the opposite, that the world was going to hate them. Um,
Number three, if you want to use,
if you want God to use you in a big way or in big ways, start serving in small ways. Again, this was part of his pattern. He didn't just sort of turn it on when he went to the New Hebrides. This was ministry he was involved in distributing tracts and city missionary work there in a very degraded section of Glasgow, Scotland. I believe that Peyton showed himself to be faithful in little things, and God gave him greater opportunity and greater influence, allowed his gifts to be recognized, his passion to be affirmed by the church. So get involved in serving. Don't think, oh, I don't have that much influence. Get involved with the little influence you have. Everyone down to some of you small kids have younger kids that are looking up to you. Right? You can have an impact in their lives even now. Right? Number four, we ought to evaluate our priorities as parents. I thought this was a challenge. Hearing a little bit about Peyton's father. And I remember talking with a missions administrator. This has been 10, 15 years ago. It's a group of pastors. And we just said, what are some of the biggest issues you're facing? And like in his top three challenges in global missions was Christian parents. Who want nothing to do with their child going that far away from home, or their grandkids being, you know, displaced. He said, this is a major issue in our culture. I don't know, I just pricked my conscience again as I was reading about Peyton's father and how he released his kids. Now, what's you? I'd rather have my kids walking with the Lord in Timbuktu than living for the devil in my neighborhood. You know, I think we got to be really clear on what the goal is here. Number five, maintain a long-term perspective. This didn't happen overnight. 30 years with self-seed cannibals. If the story would be 10 years with self-seed cannibals, we wouldn't have seen the results that we saw. But he gave for the long haul, poured himself in. They were able to not only hear the words of the gospel, but to see his pattern of life over time. And that paid great dividends. Number six, people need the gospel. There's a lot of critique about early missionary efforts. If you read journals and such, certainly in the secular culture, the thought here, the critique, is that these people are like, these natives are in this pristine culture, and we step in and pollute it. And westernize it. And that can be a problem at times. There were some instances where, there's colonialization going on during some of these times. And so, in some cases, Western entities, England, Britain, France, are coming in and they're profiting in different ways. And so, I'm not saying that's not something we have to wrestle with. But you have to realize what was going on in these people groups. These people lived in constant fear and conflict. He wrote in his autobiography, "We found the natives in a very excited and unsettled state. Threatened wars kept them in a constant terror. War betwixt distinct tribes or adjoining villages or nearest neighbors. Like I was afraid to be attacked by the other tribe or maybe by my next door neighbor. I might be their dinner tomorrow night. You might be my dinner." No, just kidding. How would you like to live with that, right? I mean, that's a horrible... There's another account. They had a skirmish between a couple of these tribes. Five people died and were eaten, by the way. The next night, they hear a big commotion in the village. One of the warriors had been injured, and he died. So they proceeded to kill his wife, so that she could accompany him into the afterlife. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's going on here, you know. So, the reality is people need the gospel. You know, sometimes we think, oh, their life looks okay. You know, sin brings destruction, and it just does. People are living for themselves. It's hollow. It doesn't satisfy. And reality is people need the gospel. We need to be reminded of that in a politically correct culture where we're kind of told to mind our own business, right? Leave people alone. And this is a pretty graphic example, but I think it's a true reflection of humanity run amok and our need for the gospel.